All right. Yesterday we were making our way slowly through this Presbyterian family tree, having discussed the division of the Presbyterian Church from 1837 forward, in which one church became four, and then ultimately, after the Civil War, reunions between Northern Old School, New School, and reunions between Southern Old School, New School would end up forming two churches, North and South, after the Civil War. Okay. Now, just tracing out a little bit further, the Northern Church. After 1869, you had a reunion between Old and New School Presbyterians, and attempts were made then to unify North and South into the 1870s, but to no avail. So even after the Civil War, running through the end of the 19th century, there was no reunification between Northern and Southern Presbyterian churches. In 1906, you have the Cumberland Presbyterian Church reuniting with the Presbyterian Church USA North. So the Cumberland Presbyterian Church that broke off back here in 1810 due to the Second Great Awakening, by 1906, reunites with the Northern Church. Okay. We should trace out one more distinct church within this tree, really, and that's down here. I want to take a quick look down here at the United Presbyterian Church of North America. If you look at the chart here, it goes all the way back as well to the 18th century, in which you have Reformed Presbyterians and Associate Presbyterians uniting in 1782, and then this movement of multiple synods breaking and reuniting and forming United Presbyterian Church of North America. Yep. Oh, I'm sorry. Am I off the chart here?
Yeah, let's move up.
If you're following on your chart, I'm down here on the bottom here, moving through to United Presbyterian Church of North America. Now, the origins of this lineage, if we can describe it this way down here, have roots back into the Scottish Covenanters tradition, the Irish Seceders tradition, who settled when they migrated from Ireland and Scotland in New York and in southeast Pennsylvania and in parts of South Carolina as well. And eventually, western Pennsylvania would be the stronghold of this tradition, particularly around the city of Pittsburgh, in which these Covenanter ministers, previously dealing with their rejection of monarchical rule back in England and Scotland from Charles II to James II, and then coming to the United States to form their Reformed Presbyterian denomination. These seceders then organized to form the Associate Presbyterian Church, and then a union here with the Reformed Presbyterians, Scotsmen and Irishmen, joining together. They again supported the War of Independence, and in 1782 formed the Associate Reformed Church. Okay. Now, they're characterized by a number of what we would describe as distinct characteristics to their denomination. First, a strong and deep devotion to piety, but not revivalistic. Yeah, they were not in favor of the revivals, but yet there was a strong character of devotion and piety within their tradition. They opposed slavery, and they also rejected membership from those who were involved in secret societies like the Masons and others. Okay. Endorsed the principle of covenanting. They were exclusive psalmists, and then likewise heavily involved with the Civil War, ministering particularly to refugee slaves. Okay. Now, the United Presbyterian Church of North America would ultimately merge also with the PCUSA, and you see the line then moving up here, 1958 later on. Okay. This reunion then that would join this denomination with the main line, if we could put it that way, PCUSA by 1958. Now, it's important to trace out one other lineage here that goes forward. And here I'm going to scoot the chart over a little bit here. The Presbyterian Church in the U.S., or during the Civil War, the Presbyterian Church of the Confederate States, you'll note there, does not unite with the PCUSA through the post-Civil War era. And instead, and we'll talk a little bit more about this in detail, you'll notice a southern church and a northern church now moving through the early 20th century. And we'll speak more about this later, but you'll see what happens to the northern church. 1936, the Orthodox Presbyterian Church forms with J. Gresham Machen, breaking off from the PCUSA. We'll look more in detail at that later. 1938, then, the Bible Presbyterian Church, breaking off of the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. Again, we'll look in some details later. That has a lot to do with the early history of Westminster Seminary and what happened to that first generation. And then you have another break, 1956, of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church breaking off of the Bible Presbyterian Church. Okay? If you know the name Francis Schaeffer, he was very involved in a number of these movements, having started as a seminary student here at Westminster, leaving Princeton Seminary with J. Gresham Machen, pulling out with the Bible Presbyterians, but realizing that they were too fundamentalistic, and we'll talk about what that means later. Evangelical Presbyterian Church forming out of that. Note also there is a, shall we say, a genealogy of seminaries that follows with those breaks as well. Westminster formed out of Princeton. Faith Theological Seminary formed out of the Bible Presbyterian Church's break with the OPC, and then ultimately Biblical Theological Seminary forming out of the Evangelical Presbyterian Church's break with the Bible Presbyterians. Okay, so you have a kind of a formation of new churches alongside of new seminaries that came along with the breaks that formed out of the Northern Church. Everyone following that history there? We're going to look in more detail later at the formation of the OPC and that break. But if you look then on the Southern Church and you move forward here with the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. as it continued, distinct from the Northern Church, it's not until 1973, do you see here, with the distinct now break of the Presbyterian Church in America, PCA, that comes out of the Southern tradition. Okay, so many of us very familiar. I'm a member of the PCA. That tradition is actually a Southern Presbyterian tradition in which events in 1973, very similar to the same events that happened in the 1930s to the PCUSA, conservatives in the South broke from the Southern Church as a result of their concern of the Southern Church moving liberal, just like the Northern Church had already done, at least according to Machen. Okay? This was the great split of the Southern Church that would lead to the formation of the PCA, and it's fascinating to hear that history, particularly from, we have a number of board members who are founding members of the PCA who lived through that split in formation. Men like Frank Barker, who was the former senior minister of Briarwood Presbyterian Church, Charles Dunahoo, who just retired as, a Christian Ed in the coordinator in the PCA, and Charles McGowan and others that are on our board were part of that first generation that left the PCUS to form the Presbyterian Church in America. Okay? Now, you'll note, by 1958, this UPC, or United Presbyterian of North American Church, joins with the PCUSA, Northern Church here, to form the United Presbyterian Church in the USA, which, by 1983, would form the Presbyterian Church USA as it exists today. So by 1983, you finally have reunification between the mainline Southern Church and the mainline Northern Church to form one mainline Presbyterian Church in America again, the PCUSA. Okay. Now, two small details here as well. You'll note here, in 1965, the Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod that breaks off from the Evangelical Presbyterian Church. Actually, it morphs into, the EPC morphs into the Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod. Okay? Note, this EPC, Evangelical Presbyterian Church, is not the EPC that you and I are probably a little more familiar with today. Orland Presbyterian Church, just down Church Road over here, used to be a PCUSA church that came out of the PCUSA recently and is now in the Evangelical Presbyterian denomination. Not the same one, okay? Not the same one there. The EPC that exists today, fascinating, has become quite a safe haven for a lot of conservative PCUSA churches that are pulling out of the mainline denomination right now, moving into the EPC. That's not the same, so I want to keep that distinct in your minds. But this Evangelical Presbyterian Church forms the Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod that would then join with the Evangelical Presbyterian Church here. Okay, or excuse me, no, this Evangelical Presbyterian Church here, just to be clear, is the EPC that we're talking about with Orland. The Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod is important for a couple of reasons for the PCA. One, the Reformed Evangelical Presbyterian Synod is the church in which Covenant Seminary and Covenant College were first formed under. Okay? Covenant College and Covenant Seminary being the denominational schools of the Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod. So if you follow the line here and it moves up 1982, Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synod joins with the PCA in 1982, which ultimately brings Covenant Seminary and Covenant College as the denominational schools of the PCA. Okay. So PCA, I mean, for me at least, coming to the PCA late, it always fascinated me that you would have a northern school, Covenant, in St. Louis. I guess it wouldn't technically be northern for the Civil War, but more geographically north, yet being the denominational seminary of the PCA. And that comes in through Reformed Presbyterian Evangelical Synods joining with the Presbyterian Church in America. Now, from 1982 forward, one other detail to note, which students have written on as papers in this class, there were a number of discussions that went on, particularly between the OPC and the PCA, to discuss union of these two denominations, the Joining and Receiving Act. And fascinating, we'll look at this history a little more detail later, number of opportunities in which professors at this seminary as well were highly involved in trying to bring a union between these two conservative reformed denominations. And at one point, actually I think it may have been twice, but I know for certain at least at one point, the OPC voted itself out of existence. The denomination voted to join the PCA. And interesting enough, it was the PCA that rejected the OPC at that point in time. And part of that is, if I could put it this way, intertwined with the history of this institution at Westminster. We'll get into it in more detail, but just to kind of whet your appetite on this, one of the major reasons the PCA rejected the OPC was over issues of theological integrity. And that may surprise some of you, given that if you look at the OPC and PCA today, you would kind of think that the OPC tends to be a more conservative denomination, the PCA tends to be a more broader denomination. Well, during those years in which these discussions were going on, Westminster entered probably its first theological controversy as a seminary over the teachings of Norman Shepherd, systematic professor at this institution. Professor Shepherd was a OPC minister. And there were great concerns in the PCA that at the time that the OPC was not dealing with Professor Shepherd's theology, and that ultimately they did not want to join with the denomination that had yet to make a firm stand on what they thought was, positions regarding particularly the doctrine of justification that were not consistent with our confessional standards. Right? Fascinating to see that would have an impact on the ecclesiastical discussions between the OPC and the PCA. Joining and receiving never happened. Even our own president at that time, Edmund Clowney, who was very involved with trying to bring this unification, very involved in the Shepherd issues as well, as he was the president of that of this institution at that time, would ultimately leave the OPC and join the PCA himself. Okay. So we'll get to that history in more detail later, but just to let you know the background to RP Evangelical Synod joining with the PCA and why the denomination OPC and PCA remains distinct today, which I think is a fascinating discussion because we do have so many Reformed denominations out there, conservative ones, yet there is no discussion today about unification. And there's always that question, is that really something that we should strive for? How does that fit with biblical mandates for unity, particularly within denominations that are so very, very close? Test case happened when I was in seminary, in which the Christian Reformed Church was undergoing its own controversies, particularly as the denomination had moved to accept women ordination. At the time, President of Westminster, California, where I was studying, Robert Godfrey was a member of the CRC and led an exodus of conservative CRC ministers out of the denomination as a result of that action. There was a lot of discussion, why don't you join PCA, OPC? And instead, they formed their own denomination, United Reformed Church. And again, it was a very interesting time to hear the discussion, why do we need another Reformed denomination? Sure, you've pulled out of the CRC, but why not join one of the existing Reformed denominations? The argument that Dr. Godfrey gave, I remember at the time, was to maintain some distinct Dutch Reform roots that they wanted to hold on to coming out of the CRC. But again, I think it's a live question to always ask, whether or not such efforts for unification should continue even today. Okay. And when you talk to particularly some of the ministers back in the OPC and the PCA at that time, I think some of them would still say they wish those efforts would continue, even though, practically speaking, they're not. Nothing's going on right now. All right, questions up to this point on this brief outline of Presbyterian history in North America. Any questions?
You said that when the Southern Old School and Southern New School reunited, there was mostly Old School and New School basically disappeared.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What about in the North?
Yeah. The North will always have the tension of Old School, New School. And part of that being there is a stronger New School presence in the North, and it will continue and morph itself into some very, very more contemporary, if I should describe it that way, movements. That's going to be part of some interesting discussions. So, for example, Daryl Hart has made the argument, following along some of George Marsden's works, that the liberal wing of the Northern Church that will emerge by the end of the 20th, the end of the 19th into the early 20th century will tend to be New School in orientation. That the New Schoolers who are already influenced by early New Divinity theology, their revivalist impulse, would then be attractive as the next step in their progression toward liberal theology, and that it would be the Old Schoolers like Machen and others who would then oppose the New Schoolers of their day, which would be much more liberal. This is part of Marsden's argument. This is part of what Daryl Hart argues. So the tensions are there, but they take a different form. One would argue, I think Daryl Hart actually makes this argument as well, too, that there are New School ideas that are still resident even when the OPC splits as well, too. And some would look at particularly the New Life movement that comes out of the OPC as, again, another New School kind of influence that continued on even within conservative Reformed denominations of the North. That now, are they exact? No. But it's just that tendency that they would describe as New School that is a legacy of Northern New School progression, if we could put it that way. But definitely during the modernist fundamentalist debates, if you take particularly Marsden's research on this, I think it's pretty clear that you have more those in the legacy of New School being attracted to liberal modernist theology at the time. Other questions on this outline here? Nope. Okay. What I'd like to do now is back up a little bit and go back into the Civil War period, in which we looked at this one church becoming four, but look more specifically now at some of the theological issues that impacted the American church in the 19th century that relates once again to what it means to be in America, wrestling with theological issues after the fall of the Puritan canopy, but now also heavily now charged by the political context in which I mentioned yesterday. You have political issues of secession, states' rights, and yet also the abiding moral issue of slavery. Okay. And how does that impact the church? Brief history for those who are not as familiar. Civil War in the United States raged from about 1861 to 1865. It's estimated that over 620,000 individuals died during the war. Some obviously from combat, others from disease, and all the results of the waste that war would lay on the lands, particularly in the South during the Civil War. Much of the South lay in ruins after the Civil War. And most secular historians have argued that the Civil War influenced the general course of American intellectual life by demonstrating how Northern intellectuals of the upper class pushed religious convictions aside and focused on the more pragmatic solutions found by applying science and rational business practices. Again, note that what this statement is describing, put that off, is the movement away from religious convictions, particularly in the North, and the focus on pragmatic solutions that would adopt scientific methods and rational business practices. Okay? These secular historians describe the Civil War, then, as a redefinition of sacred values, but now filled with secular content and meaning. But do these studies do justice, I would ask, to the strong religious influence that you can point to and identify still, even in the period of the Civil War? No question, the nation was both politically and economically fractured, sociologically or socially and ideologically broken. But yet at the same time, when you investigate the writings of the period, you cannot help but see yet still a strong religious component to the context and events of the Civil War. No question, the war was fought for political issues. No question, states' rights was very central. No question, there was a moral issue undergirding all of this. Yet at the same time, I would argue that there were deep theological justifications on both sides that led America and American theology in some very, very unique directions. So the question we must ask is, how did religion influence and shape the Civil War over against some of these secular interpretations? More specifically, what sort of theology was at work? And how did that theology function in such a volatile and devastating circumstance? Okay? So again, understand the question, the historical question. Secular historians say intellectualism, rationalism, really Enlightenment approaches dominated America as a result of the Civil War, pushing aside religious convictions. I and other historians like Mark Knoll would prefer to argue that no, there is actually still a very strong religious component, and in fact it's even deeper than just broad religion, but that there is a theological component to what is operating within the Civil War that does have, in fact, a significant impact on the events of that period of time. Now, the context is still common sense realism, a very dominant philosophical expression that has wedded itself to much theological constructions. Republicanism, of course, America being a republic and now that being applied within the context of states and their rights. And yet at the same time, some who would still be urging for a revivalistic method to religious practice within the context. And it's very important to see that by and large, even with, and I don't deny, the strong intellectual strain, particularly in the North, that was being shaped by rationalism and moving towards secularism, but we cannot deny at the same time that by and large, most people in America would still have a very high regard for the Bible. And the Bible as authoritative, and the Bible as influential for how one should live. Okay? So in other words, I think if you look more carefully at the evidence, there's no question there were those who were moving in a secular, scientific, and rational direction. They tended to be, as that quote I earlier read is correct, it tended to be Northern intellectuals, which I would describe as a very elite class within the social structures of America. But if you did a wider survey of the general populace of America, both North and South, I think you would find that the majority of the people would still have a very high regard for the Bible as authoritative in their lives. Okay, so the first question we must ask is, why go to war? We've already hinted at this already. What were the issues at the outset? Of course, the issue was never just political, even though it was part of it. States' rights, the right to secede, the right to govern themselves, the right to have certain practices within the state, even though other states may deny that such practices were legitimate, and in particular, for their issue, the question of slavery. The South felt that their rights were being violated, specifically the right to maintain themselves as a slave-holding society. And the North was fueled by abolitionists calling for the end of slavery and on the wider political issue to preserve the Union. Okay. Now, January 1st, 1863, President Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln, issues the final Emancipation Proclamation freeing all slaves in territories held by the Confederates and emphasizing the enlisting of black soldiers in the Union Army, and that the war to preserve the Union would now become a revolutionary struggle for the abolition of slavery. Now again, from a historical side, there are a lot of historians that argue how wise this action was on Lincoln's side. In fact, there are some theologians even who argue that Lincoln should have never issued the Emancipation Proclamation. That had he not pressed the issue so hard, that potentially slavery would have just died itself out anyways, without as much bloodshed, 620,000 lives lost, and a general kind of, some would argue, and I think this has a bit of a kind of post-millennial flavor to it, that Christianity would essentially, ultimately, rid the nation of slavery at some point, that there would just be this trajectory that people would move on. Again, historical speculation. You can sit around and think about that and wonder, but of course that never happened. Yet at the same time, there were some who would argue that that's the course of action that should have happened. Now, it seems to be clear, right, that Christians at that time, good Bible-believing Christians, should in fact be anti-slavery. Isn't it not the case, particularly from our vantage point, we would say, isn't that the logical extension of our Christian belief that slavery is wrong? The simple answer to that question in the Civil War shows that that was not always the case for Christians during that time. In fact, the issue was much more complicated when you relate it to one's faith. Mark Knoll writes, at the time of the Civil War, the party of abolitionists, from whom nothing matched the imperatives of personal freedom, was much more worrisome to traditional believers. Foremost in this group was William Lloyd Garrison, who in 1845 paid homage in The Liberator, a magazine, to Thomas Paine for providing him with intellectual resources for getting beyond the Bible. Okay? Knoll is saying here, look, these abolitionists, they were Republicans to the core. They were common sense realists who believed everyone has freedom, everyone has ability to think. These are principles and practices that we must all adopt as modern intellectual individuals. Slavery is wrong because every human being, by virtue of them being humans, have rights and liberties, intellectual capacities, by virtue of how they were created as human beings. And Noel points out, William Lloyd Garrison, one of the leading abolitionists, writes, thanking Thomas Paine, this philosopher, for providing him the intellectual tools to get beyond the Bible. In other words, to reject the Bible. That seems strange. Abolitionists, anti-slavery, anti-Bible at the same time. Yeah? Garrison wrote, to say that everything contained within the lids of the Bible is divinely inspired, and to insist upon the dogma as fundamentally important is to give utterance to a bold fiction and to require the suspension of the reasoning faculties. To say that everything in the Bible is to be believed simply because it's found in that volume is equally absurd and pernicious. Wow. This guy absolutely now is rejecting biblical authority. No, it's not divinely inspired. It's a bold fiction. You have to suspend your rational faculties if you want to read and believe the Bible. Absolutely absurd for the intellectual. Now, why would Garrison, an abolitionist, hold to such a secular view of the Bible? He believed, ultimately, Garrison, that to read the Bible literally, to follow the Bible specifically, as conservative Christians claim they do, he believed if you did that, the Bible would lead you to the conclusion that slavery was, in fact, legitimate. Okay? He writes, to discard a portion of Scripture is not necessary to reject the truth, but maybe the highest evidence that one can give of his love for truth. In other words, Garrison said, look, there's passages in the Bible that seem to support slavery. And you conservative Christians believe everything in the Bible, right? And you say you're seeking truth from the Bible, yet there are passages there that Garrison say, well, Garrison says that seems to endorse the practice of slavery. If you really want to seek truth, the highest evidence of that is to reject portions of the Bible like those portions that seem to endorse or support slavery. Garrison saw the problem of the Bible and chose simply to avoid it, go around it, forget it. Don't even address those biblical issues. Simply moved to the position of what he had already received of Republican ideas and common sense philosophy to argue this is who every individual, every man and woman has, rights, liberties, intellectual abilities, and get out of the Bible. Get past the Bible. Move beyond the Bible. For Garrison, this was the solution, and the abolitionist cause in the North, in many cases, followed that logic. Okay? They followed that logic. Now, you might say, doesn't that seem a little bit odd? Doesn't that seem a bit strange to approach the issue of slavery and set it against the Bible in that way? Well, the majority of Americans, like I said before, both in North and South, looked at Garrison's conclusions about the Bible and were very concerned. In fact, Garrison's justification for abolition, Noel says, worked to the advantage of good Southern Bible-believing slaveholders. See? These abolitionists arguing against the Bible in the South, the Christians there said, if that's where abolition goes, these abolitionists thinking, then that ultimately is anti-Christian. And we can't follow them. We can't follow them. It will ultimately lead to the rejection of the Bible to follow the abolitionist cause. Now, in the middle of this, of course, those who were probably the most strained in this debate would be those Christians in the North who had sympathies for abolition, yet at the same time were caught because their Southern brethren in the South are saying, well, this abolitionist up there, those guys are anti-Christian. Are you going to go down that road and reject the Bible as well in your anti-slavery sentiments? And the tension point comes between Northern and Southern theologians to wrestle with, well, what does the Bible actually teach? The abolitionists are convinced, the intellectuals convinced, the Bible teaches slavery. So if you're gonna reject slavery, you can't hold to the Bible literally. Southern theologians looking at that and saying, see, that's what abolitionists leads to. It leads to anti-Christianity, rejection of the Bible. The Northern theologians have the pressure now of having to respond and handle biblical interpretation as to whether or not the Bible does, in fact, allow for slavery or not. Is everyone following that? They're following the intellectual and theological tension that is emerging as a result of abolitionism in the North and the North and South theologically having now the question of whether or not the Bible does in fact support slavery or not. And again, just for your knowledge, I mean, you look in passages in the Bible, New and Old Testament, where Paul talks about slaves being obedient to their masters, where it seems like there's been certain injunctions, certain allowances for Israel to have slaves in the Old Testament. What do you do with those passages? How do you understand them? Will become a major issue for the theologians here in the era of the Civil War. Questions up to this point on what's happening with the discussion? Go ahead. Oh yeah, yeah. They would see universality both in terms of morals, in terms of intellectual ability, and in terms of rights, as that which every human being has and must have by virtue of them being human. It's universal. It's who we are as humans. No different in terms of race. It's just and that's what they're leaning upon as justification for anti-slavery. And they're saying, Bible doesn't teach that. So get rid of the Bible. Yeah. That's their argument. Yeah.
Was there anybody prominent trying to make like a real argument saying that the Bible might teach slavery, but it doesn't teach the kind of slavery that's found?
Yeah, hang on to that, because that's what we're going to look at. We're going to look at now, because the pressure is the Northern and Southern theologians now will enter into debate over what the Bible actually does teach. Because for the Northerners, they've got to justify their anti-slavery position without moving down the secular abolitionist route and say that we have to get around the Bible. They're going to have to respond. In one sense, the Southerners have a kind of a strong upper hand here against them, because they have no problem saying the Bible does endorse slavery. And at the same time, they have an example of one who is anti-slavery, and the arguments for it are all anti-Christian as well. The Southerners feel they have a very strong, at least theological leverage now, in terms of their position. Okay? Other questions? Go ahead.
So when we talk about theologians here, who are we talking about? Are we just talking about average pastors?
Pastors and seminaries? Yeah, pastors and seminary professors. Thornwell in the South, Dabney, others will write on this. Hodge will engage in the North. Lots of pastors, too, involved in both sides of the discussion as well. Yeah. So by and large, it's being done by leaders, theological leaders on both sides, who are writing in print, whether they be books, pamphlets, newspapers, articles. This is now going to start to go back and forth as to justify what the Bible actually teaches in regards to this major moral issue that they're wrestling with. Yeah. Other questions into this one? Go ahead, one more hit.
Yeah. Are we talking mainly about Presbyterians now, or were other denominations in play? Did Presbyterians have so much of the South?
No, it's everybody. And we'll see, because I'm going to pull examples in a minute that are not just Presbyterian examples. There's no question that what we saw in terms of the split with the Presbyterian Church between North and South, we could, if we had time, trace that out in other denominations as well. Every denomination, essentially, by and large, most of the major ones especially, will split over the issue of slavery in the mid-19th century and form Northern and Southern denominations as a result. Southern Baptist Convention being an example of that in the Baptist tradition. The SBC is formed in this period of time as a Southern Baptist church, and the issue was slavery and states' rights for them as well. Same thing going on in every denomination.
Mm-hmm. Pushing against like a scriptural hermeneutic.
Yeah.
So, is there any reason to think that people like Garrison were primarily anti-Christian or primarily pro-abolition?
Yeah. Yeah. I hard to know. I think you would have to take case by case priority of that abolitionist in terms of where they were, but I would say probably for a guy like Garrison, it's both. In other words, he sees the way forward. And there's a host of issues out there, and the way forward is reject Christianity, adopt the movement towards this philosophical, secular, humanistic approach, and it will solve a ton of problems probably in his mind. He sees that as the next step forward in all of this. Yeah. Question?
Yeah. What was the real kind of, who started it?
Right. Yeah, there's no question there's overlap, but even if one were to look at, say, Finney's anti-slavery position, theologically, there's already shifts going on there as well that is leading one to reject Orthodox Christianity, at least as Finney's contemporaries judged him. And it's fascinating you bring this up because, of course, at this point in time, historically, Britain has already gone through its anti-slavery period, in which it has already outlawed slavery by this point in time. And yet, historically, it was heavily motivated by Christian efforts, Wilberforce and others, right? This is, I would argue, historically very different and a fascinating turn to see that the abolitionist movement in America is not as, shall we say, strongly undergirded by Christian beliefs as it was in Britain at the time, earlier. But you can see, and I would argue, and the reason why is this, because Britain is not influenced, as we had looked at earlier, with the collision of common sense realism and republicanism the way America has. So the outgrowth of that in America, when it gets to the issue of slavery, you have now abolitionist thinkers who are saturated in a universal equality, both intellectually as well as in terms of politically civil equality that you don't have in Europe. And the abolitionist movement in Europe has a very, very different motivation that tends to be more Christian as we, if you look at the history of it, where in America is very, very different. And again, that's to reinforce the thesis that America is unique on this because of what it went through in the 18th century with the intellectual shifts and changes that led to the fall of the Puritan canopy. Okay. So again, I see that as a reinforcement of what we're trying to argue for, the difference between what happened in Britain against slavery and what we're describing here.
Question. What you just said was very interesting. So what you're saying is that America was kind of exalting the civil structure as opposed to what Paul said, is that there's no Greek or Jew, I mean, all are one in Christ. Could you say that, or is that...
Well, see, what you're describing from a biblical perspective, I would say, if I were to compare anti-slavery movement in Britain that ended slave trade in Britain versus that which ended it in the U.S., you know, Britain didn't fight a civil war over this, you know. And the motivation for abolitionists like Wilberforce and others was much more motivated by Christian principles like that, that they believed the gospel had this direction that would ultimately lead to the end of slavery. And they worked for that, politically even worked for that, and were able to accomplish that. But you're in a context that's very different than the American context, in which such understandings of Christianity were rejected because the context is much more saturated, which Britain is not, with common sense philosophy and Republican ideas defending why one is equal. I mean, you've got a nation now formed under equality that is arguing that every citizen is equal. Europe, moving in that direction, yet still has old social structures that are not quite undergirded forcefully the way America was founded in that way. And that, I think that is Mark Knowles' thesis from America's God, that, see, this, the shift happens here in America that doesn't happen anywhere else. And one of the byproducts of that is an abolitionist who says at that point in time, look, common sense realist philosophy, Republican ideas, they've saturated my thinking. I'm, you know, maybe not even consciously saying that, but recognizing that equality can be achieved and justified without biblical foundations. Well, that's the whole common sense approach. Let's suspend the Bible for a minute. And lo and behold, for these abolitionists, when you actually look at the Bible, well, then there's these problematic passages that seem to support slavery that these Southern theologians constantly are quoting. Well, what's the best way to get by that? Well, we've got to reject those parts of the Bible. There's the anti-Christian rub in that sense. Question?
How did religious groups that were considered abolitionists, for example, Quakers,
yeah, yeah,
as a group handle the situation?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. This is where we're going to get to in a minute here is Quakers and other conservative Christians in the North will now have to provide some theological justification over against the abolitionists on one side who say get rid of the Bible and the Southerners on the other side who are saying the Bible allows for our practice. That will be now a biblical theological debate that Northern Christians will have to respond to now as a result of this tension.
Are less concerned somehow.
Right.
Does that, first of all, I mean, we don't have to talk about whether or not that's true. I'm just asking if it is true, do you think that that would go back to an intellectual context, like the difference between driving abolition in Europe or the UK and driving abolition in the States?
Oh, definitely. There is a. I mean, you read Garrison's writing; it's very clear. He's looking at these conservative Christians and saying, "If you think it's divinely inspired and authoritative at every point, we've got a problem. We've got a big problem with that." But at the same time, when you look at the writings that come, particularly from the anti-slavery period of Britain by Christians, their high regard for the Bible, I don't see very different. I don't see that as very different. I think that the difference that emerges is the sophistication of argument that by the 1860s, these abolitionists have because they've got philosophical weapons that they prefer to use. Weapons that they've been saturated in, at least in America, for now 100 years since common sense realism first started hitting the shores. Now, British context is very different. Common sense realism does not have the impact on British philosophical thinking and then ultimately British theological thinking in the same way. So we'd have to look very carefully at that British context to understand what they are doing there, but it's, in my opinion, it's very clear that it has a huge impact on the American context to reach this point in which you have people saying, yeah, Bible, yeah. Now the question always is, you know, what do we mean by inerrant? What do we mean by these discussions of the Bible as being authoritative and truthful? And this, again, is going to force these theologians to investigate that question because it can't simply be, a bare literalism or simple reading that will lead you, because that ultimately, at least in the South, will lead to the conclusion that, look, Paul seems to legitimize slaves, be obedient to your masters. This is going to be a very difficult, now, biblical debate on this point. Okay.
How did the conservative Southern theologians interact with conservative theologians in Europe? Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It'll be an interesting study to look at. I don't know how much interaction was going on, to be honest. I'm sure there was some, but I just haven't looked to see what was happening with their interaction with what's happening in Europe. My suspicion is they would make the same arguments. They would make the same arguments that, no, I don't agree with your exegesis. The Bible does give allowances to this. And your rejection of it is probably leading you towards some liberal position. My suspicion is that's the basic argument. Just seeing how they're responding to Northern theologians, I'm guessing will be very similar. But we'll look at some of those responses in just a minute. Here. Okay? Let's go ahead and take a break here. We'll come back then and begin to look at what the debate now begins to teach us in terms of how Northern and Southern theologians were wrestling with this theological issue from the Bible. And we'll come back after the break and look at this. All right, now backing up just a little bit into the 18th century, it's worth noting the pattern of theological debate that begins to emerge. One example, Thomas Thompson, who published his book, The African Trade for Negro Slaves, shown to be consistent with principles of humanity and the laws of revealed religion, okay, in which Thompson argued that the Old Testament in particular allowed for slavery, but with limits, particularly looking at Leviticus 25. Likewise, the New Testament, he argued, also endorsed slavery in books like Philemon, and that how then can modern slavery be summarily rejected by Christians? In other words, he's making an argument that says, look, can you absolutely say that the Bible does not allow slavery? And he would argue that such absolute statements you could not make given certain biblical passages. Now, Mark Knoll describes, it was no coincidence that the biblical defense of slavery remained strongest in the United States, a place where democratic, anti-traditional, and individualistic religion was also strongest. And again, that builds on his earlier thesis. In particularly passages like Genesis 9 and 17, chapters 9 and chapter 17, Deuteronomy 20, Paul's writings in Romans 13, Colossians 3, all of these passages become the area in which anti-slavery or pro-slavery discussions would focus on in terms of biblical references. Now, there were two defining publications that came out in the mid-19th century. When the Triennial Gathering of the American Baptist Missionary Union decided in 1844 not to appoint slaveholders as missionaries, this action led the following year to the formation of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845. So again, now we're looking at Baptist tradition in particular. 1844, the Baptist Missionary Union rejects, again, slaveholders as missionaries, and the Southern Baptist Church is formed in 1845. The Reverend Richard Fuller argued then for the legitimacy of slavery, and he was opposed by Francis Whalen, at that time president of Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Let me put these names up for you. The first is Richard Fuller. And Francis Whalen. And Whalen at the time, president of Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. Fuller argued that the Bible supported slavery. So to deny slavery in principle was to deny the Bible. Again, he's got the abolitionists in mind. Whalen responded by saying that there is a principle of the gospel. Now, note what he's doing. He's talking about a general principle of the gospel that would lead one ultimately to an anti-slavery position. In other words, Whalen's tactic, instead of going kind of verse by verse and trying to refute a specific verse that would be cited by the pro-slavery side, he stepped back and said, no, but just look at the whole direction of the gospel in the Bible. Look at the direction that the gospel is going in. If you follow that direction, ultimately it would lead you to a position that would reject slavery. Moses Stewart, head of Andover Seminary, would also write and weigh in on this debate, in which Stewart claimed he would not name slavery as a moral evil, but instead argued that slavery should gradually, peacefully, and voluntarily be phased out as an institution. Okay? Again, in his writing, Stewart would not say slavery is an absolute moral evil, but instead argued that it should be gradually, peacefully, and voluntarily phased out as an institution. In other words, Stewart is building on Whalen's argument that saying, look, just the general gospel direction, the general trend in which the gospel is going, would lead us then to ultimately phase out slavery. Now, the difficulty here for these northern theologians in particular was that the South was very firm, as James Thornwell stated on The Evil of the Civil War, that this was an issue, quote, we have long since settled, end quote. Believing then that there was a biblical sanction for the institution of slavery. Okay? So the South wasn't moving at all in these debates. Thornwell declared, this issue is settled for us. We do believe that the Bible does allow for slavery, and the North is trying to wrestle with these biblical texts, and the first argument or the first response is to simply say there's a gospel direction here, a broad gospel direction that would ultimately lead Christians to an anti-slavery position. Again, Mark Knoll writes, the primary reason that the biblical defense of slavery remained so strong was that many biblical attacks on slavery were so weak. To oversimplify a complicated picture, the most direct biblical attacks on slavery were ones that relied on common sense. The broadly accepted moral intuitions of American national ideology and the weight of self-evident truths. What Knoll is saying is that even the conservatives in the North kind of said, well, you know, it's just self-evident that there's this gospel direction. It's intuitive that we know that it's supposed to go this way and that the Bible has this general trend. And Knoll says that the Northern theologians offered extremely weak biblical responses as this debate began. Many suppose that the basic meaning of American identity as Republicans, those influenced by common sense realists, and in the North, at least for the conservative Christians, those who were Bible-believing, would just lead us towards a rejection of slavery. And they believe that this was the most powerful kind of movement that should be presented from a Christian perspective. Anti-slavery, again, focusing on the overarching message, not taking any specific passage literally, but describing the overarching direction of the Bible. Now, the debate then shifted from the Bible never condemning slavery, but being much more focused to looking at the types of slavery that the Bible may or may not allow for. In other words, certain northern theologians, to a certain extent, gave a bit of a concession and said, look, okay, we can't argue the Bible absolutely forbids slavery, but let's more specifically identify what type of slavery we're talking about here. What type of practice, and can we be more specific about that? Okay. Connecticut congregational minister named Leonard Bacon began to look more carefully at this issue, arguing that, again, the Bible doesn't condemn slavery entirely, but Bacon argued the Bible condemns the type of slavery that you Southerners are practicing, specifically. Okay? He described Old Testament slavery, right? Because the Southerners are citing Old Testament passages. Bacon says Old Testament slavery was only specific to the relationship between Israel and the Canaanites. Southerners were not Hebrews. Africans were not descendants from Canaanites. And therefore, the practice of slavery in the South is not legitimate. Likewise, he argued, Southern slaves do not enjoy the blessing of the covenant the way the slaves of Israel did, who were also circumcised. Okay? So in other words, he's developing a little bit more sophisticated response by saying, okay, yeah, it seems very clear that Israel had the practice of slavery, but it was very specific to their relationship with the Canaanites, and it was done in such a way that these Canaanites were likewise welcomed at some level into their covenant community. Bacon's argument is, this is clearly not what you are doing in the South, therefore your version of slavery is illegitimate. Okay. The Baptist minister James Pendleton wrote, hence, when the position is established that slavery is not of necessity sinful, that it is not a sin in the abstract, pro-slavery men most ridiculously transport the idea of the innocence of slavery in the abstract to slavery in the concrete, because they can conceive of circumstances in which a master may hold a slave without doing wrong. They infer that there's nothing wrong in the system of slavery in Kentucky. They reason from what might be to what is. For example, they would say something like this: the slavery which sacredly regards the marriage union cherishes the relationship between parents and children and provides for the instruction of the slave is not sinful. Therefore, the system of slavery in Kentucky, which does none of these things, is not sinful. Is this logic? Is it not rather a burlesque on logic? Okay. Again, Pendleton's making the argument simply because the position is that slavery is not absolutely outside of biblical possibilities doesn't mean that the slavery that you're practicing, this abstract understanding that slavery could in fact exist, doesn't mean it translates, according to Pendleton, to the concrete practice of what he sees in places like Kentucky. Okay. In other words, he's saying again, what you slave owners are practicing in the South is biblically illegitimate. But they've conceded to say it's not the case that the Bible completely, absolutely denies every form of practice of slavery, only that what you're doing in the South definitely doesn't conform. Definitely doesn't conform to what we see biblically. Let me put another name here, Taylor Lewis. Taylor Lewis argued that patriarchal servitude in biblical times, again, was very different from slavery in the South. He called it patriarchal servitude as the biblical examples. Lewis argued Scripture never speaks of servants as mere property. And instead, he tried to interpret Old Testament, particularly understanding of slavery as a relationship of servitude, not a relationship of owning property. Okay. He has an interesting comment because there are passages in the Old Testament that seem to instruct the question of buying slaves. And Taylor Lewis's response was, the Old Testament allowed for the buying of non-Jewish slaves, but not the selling. Quite odd. He makes that point because he's trying to argue again, it's not a slave trade that's going on in the Old Testament. They're incorporating these people as servants here. They're not turning around and pretending they're property and buying and selling and exploiting some financial gain off of them as Taylor Lewis would see in the practice of the South. Okay. The distinction between Israel and Gentiles or heathens, he would argue, is destroyed in the new covenant in Christ. He writes, we still speak of heathen, using the term geographically and to some extent ethnologically, but not theologically, ecclesiastically, Christianly. There are no heathens. Okay. So again, he's saying, yeah, it's because of the division between Israel as Israel and those who are not Israel, non-Jewish, that you have this servitude relationship going on in the Old Testament. But in the New Testament, all those lines are abolished. All those distinctions are gone. We are all one in Christ. So he argues, Taylor Lewis, if you buy a slave and that slave becomes a Christian, you should free that slave. That slave should be set free. In all of these debates, you might be thinking, well, they don't seem very powerful from the North. The arguments don't seem to have any real sophistication. And part of it, Noel would argue it particularly, is, again, because they're operating with still strong influences of common sense realism that moves them to a direction where they're defending their position, not just from the Bible, but from more broader philosophical and political influences as well. Now, it's fascinating that in this debate, does the Bible allow it? Does the Bible not allow it? And ultimately, the debate moving towards, well, the Bible allows for some forms of slavery, but not the one you're practicing in the South. One of the questions that seems to be overlooked, or at least not addressed as much, is what historians have called the Negro question. How do you distinguish the Negro question from the slave question, as church historian Philip Schaff outlined? Okay. Initially, or I should say, in this understanding then of slavery and the position that says, well, you know, the Bible has some legitimate forms of slavery, but how does that bear upon the practice of slavery in the South that was clearly divided by racial lines? Okay. Mark Knoll describes again the inability to distinguish the Bible on slavery and the Bible on race, so that when the Civil War was over and slavery abolished, systematic racism continued unchecked as the great anomaly in a supposedly Christian America. In other words, how do you theologically justify the enslavement of certain people based on their race? If you buy the argument from the South that they're saying, look, the Bible does allow for certain forms of slavery, we therefore have a legitimate form in the South. Well, if you look at the Old Testament, one would say, okay, there's examples of slavery, and it seems to be the covenant community relative to those who they were occupying, Canaanites and others. By the time you get to the New Testament, even the Southern slave owners recognize, Southern theologians recognize, look, the Bible has passages in the New Testament that talk about everyone being one in Christ, that in Christ there are no distinctions. They're not ethnic distinctions, as non-Jews as well, as Paul describes, those now coming into Christ as well, Gentiles allowed. And yet at the same time, the Southern theologians would point to, but there are examples of slavery practiced in the New Testament as well. Now, of course, in the context of the Greco-Roman period in which the New Testament is coming out of, yes, there was slave ownership going on. But Greco-Roman slave ownership was not divided by racial lines. Right? If you're a Roman citizen, you could be a Roman citizen and be racially and ethnically all kinds of different things within the Roman Empire, yet they still practice slavery. And it wasn't over against a divide of racial distinction, but simply who they conquered, simply part of that society and culture's continual growth and expansion of the Roman Empire. But in the South, if you're going to argue that, if you're going to argue that there's a legitimacy of slavery that even the New Testament allows, but the New Testament makes no racial distinction, why would you make a racial distinction in the South then and argue that that's legitimate biblical slavery? In other words then, what is the theological, again, justification for the enslavement of certain people based upon race? Is there anyone following that? Because one can make the argument, just by reading the Southern theologian's defense biblically, that one should be able to own a white slave. That should be a possibility based on their biblical arguments. That there are little arguments that slavery can be practiced, that it was legitimate in the New Testament even, then the legitimate or logical next step is to say, okay, if you believe that, then anybody could be a slave potentially. And a white person should be a slave, could potentially be a slave. Why is it that only Africans are slaves then in the practice within the South, even though they were theologically justifying this? The Southern response to that question responded with a very specific now racial distinction in which Southerners argued that Africans were inferior in intellectual capacities. So the reason why now this practice of slavery exists in the South that is biblically allowable, in which one race is dominating the other, Southerners and even Southern theologians began to argue for racial distinctions and racial superiority and racial inferiority as part of the legitimate practice of slavery. Other factors than simply fidelity to Scripture and the practice of slavery would impact this discussion. Racial issues would emerge as well. James Thornwell argued it was the normal condition for bondage to exist when the black race was side by side with the white. Africans were limited in their capacity and culture. And God has attributed people throughout history into classes according to competency and progress. And it will require an eternal test to judge the system. Universal standards must be used by minds that are mature. Interesting on this point, Thornwell does not appeal to Scripture. He appeals to universal standards and scientific results that he believes concludes racial distinction and racial superiority as a result of the practice of slavery, or would lead into the practice of slavery. Understand, okay, and I don't want to cast Southern theologians like Thornwell in an entirely unique light on this issue. By the mid-19th century, European and North American social, and I would describe it in terms of cultural and intellectual identity and mindset, was very much to see Western culture as the pinnacle of societal and cultural progression. And that as they became in contact with other cultures and societies, whether they be in Africa, South America, or Asia, there was always this impression that we are more advanced, we are more culturally progressive, you are heathens, you are those who are out there who have not advanced as far as we have, and that cultural comparison is part of the context of the 19th century, not just in the South, but I would say more broadly as well, from Western Europe as well as North America. Remember, in the broader context, the 19th century on into the early 20th century, we'll see the expansion of European and North American imperialism and colonialization into Africa and into Asia and South America as well. The British Empire, other nations as well, would extend themselves by annexing parts of Africa, the Middle East, and Asia from the 19th century forward, in order to bring civilization to these other parts of the world. So in other words, the notion that there is cultural advancement going on and that certain cultures are advancing beyond others is not unique to the South. It's part of a wider impression going on in the 19th century. But the Southerners have made it very specific as an argument to legitimize racial distinction, black and white, and the legitimacy of slavery of one race by another, because of those advancements and cultural differences. Okay? Everyone following that? Right? This is part of what's happening here in this context, in which Thornwell likewise appeals not to Scripture on this point, but universal standards, scientific investigation by looking at cultural differences. In other words, the early forms of sociological study now starting to emerge in identifying racial and cultural differences in support of slavery. Okay.
But. So did they have, so given their position was Westerners or whites are superior in whatever capacity, so not Westerners or blacks.
Yeah.
How did they make the leap from that assertion to therefore we should enslave them?
Right. So it's a combination of saying biblically there's a legitimacy, it's possible, combined with superiority of our race in which they depend on us. They need us. They need us to help guide, because they would not be able to do that to do that on their own, to progress on their own. The worst cases that you see in Southern Ireland, just go back and look at Africa. They're living in huts. Look at the way they conduct themselves. Look at their religion, pagan religions. They haven't even advanced to Christianity over there yet. All of these things now part of the racial distinction that would affirm someone to say, no, it's actually a patriarchal, a paternal relationship of one race toward the other. That way. Now, again, I don't want to deny another factor that we cannot underestimate that's part of this discussion as well. There's an economic factor to this also. The fact that the Southern society was absolutely dependent on the slave workforce for their financial sustainability. The products that they were producing, cotton, tobacco, and other things that were being farmed, was all on the backs of a workforce that was absolutely required and created great wealth, in fact, for Southerners. This workforce was absolutely needed. And so these theological and sociological discussions have also under it a very strong economic financial component that if slavery is gone, the entire economy of the South will crumble as a result of that. Okay? So I don't want to deny that. That's there as well, too, that there's a huge economic pressure in this as well. Now, it's interesting also that when you look at particularly writings from African-American slaves of the time, focusing particularly these slaves, focusing in their oral as well as written accounts of anti-Christian aspects of slavery that were practiced. For example, beating of slaves, rape and adultery between slaveholders and slaves, breaking up of marriages and families through the sale of slaves. All of these issues seem to kind of be swept aside, seem to not be addressed by these Christian slaveholders in the South. Nevertheless, slavery then was the moral issue, no question, from the northern side. Yet at the same time, the North doesn't quite address this race issue entirely as well. In other words, as Noel points out, the fact that even after the Civil War and the end of slavery, systematic racism continued to exist in America. He indicates, at least, and I think there's some evidence to this, that even though the Northern abolitionists were likewise pushing for equality, they also accepted certain forms of racial distinction as well. And that would live on well past the end of the Civil War and the abolition of slavery in America. In many ways, that's the main question that will not be addressed through the Civil War and the freeing of the slaves until the Civil Rights Movement of the question of racial equality ultimately addressed much further along after the Civil War. Okay. I want to shift a minute now from the theological focus of what was happening with the issues of slavery to the actual war itself. Because in the context of warfare, I would argue also there are theological issues that many were wrestling with in terms of the Civil War itself and how to understand a number of issues. For example, their understanding of God's providence, as that became a very, very significant category that Christians began to investigate as it related to the Civil War. You see it in the writings of Charles Hodge. You see it in the writings of generals. You see it in the writings even of Abraham Lincoln, to try to discern what God is doing in this great war with so much bloodshed and such major issues weighing on the balance. How did Christians then, both in the North and South, respond to war and God's providence over this war? Harry Stout, the historian at Yale University, writes, "In the critical months of the spring of 1864, when Union and Confederate armies suffered horrendous and unprecedented casualties, Grant's Army of the Potomac faced Lee's Army of Northern Virginia in an area of open pines and deep ravines called Cold Harbor, Virginia. Both sides had already expended 69,000 casualties in 4 weeks of frontal assaults. Soldiers and their commanders were exhibiting unmistakable signs of shell shock. In the mistaken belief that Lee's lines were spread too thin, Grant ordered yet another frontal assault on June 3rd, intended to break through Lee's soft underbelly, roll up his army, and march on the gates of Richmond. At 4:30 a.m., the assault began. Lockstep madness, each advancing Union corps was enfiladed by Lee's cannons and musket fire on the flanks, while simultaneously receiving direct fire in front. Note the way they fought wars in the Civil War. Line up, shoot, they shoot back, you assault, they shoot back and forth. No one's hiding behind rocks. No one's doing the kind of warfare we see, guerrilla urban warfare. They are lining up and they're just firing at each other, firing back and forth at each other. This was the civilized, gentlemanly way of conducting warfare in the 19th century. Okay? Artillery batters worked their Napoleons furiously with double-charged canisters, turning the assaulting troops into a bloody mass of writhing humanity. Three assaulting Federal corps were repulsed in little over an hour, with staggering losses that totaled 7,000, a rate of roughly 116 men per minute dying. In surveying the carnage, Lee's horrified general, Evander Law, would write of the battle, quote, "It was not war, but murder." I read that quote to you to describe this bloody warfare that was going on. And yet at the same time, the rhetoric and ideology that would motivate these soldiers to go and fight and to kill each other in large numbers, the rhetoric was absolutely colored with Christian themes, theological themes, themes that would sanction such atrocities that this general would say, "This is not warfare what I'm watching, this is murder. We're killing each other in murder." From presidents to generals to soldiers to civilians, the language that they would use to justify these atrocities were heavily, heavily influenced by religious and Christian connotations, so much so that some theologians have described a civil religion that was emerging that would meld Christian values and faith into the cause, which is the cause of the war, that great cause. Harry Stout argues that this nation then, America, would then see the casualties of the war and describe them as martyrs. Sacrifices were made on the quote-unquote altar of the nation. Biblical language colored the political rhetoric and would give even deeper motivation for what was going on in the context of the Civil War. Listen even to Lincoln's acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention. He stated, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the house to fall, but I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other." You see the biblical language coloring even Abraham Lincoln's speech. And he would in fact call for national fast days. And his counterpart, Jefferson Davis in the South, would do that as well. Days in which you were to fast and pray. This is a president calling for this. National fast days. Clergy likewise served an important role and had posts within the armies, both North and South. For example, the young Presbyterian minister, Robert Dabney, would serve as Stonewall Jackson's chief of staff. So you've got these Presbyterian ministers also very much involved in the cause, believing this was God's purpose for them to go and fight this war. And of course, Stonewall Jackson, no question, he was a Presbyterian elder in the South. And you read his journals and his writings, and he was just a constant, pious, religious man, even as he led troops into battle and conducted the war as a Southern general. Pulpits were being used to proclaim the cause both in the North and the South. Northern preachers proclaiming the end of slavery. Southern preachers defending the cause of the South, believing God was with them. Listen again to Abraham Lincoln's second inaugural address. Again, he stated, God wills that this war continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. So it will be, as it is said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That's Lincoln in his inaugural address. Again, invoking, in fact, God's judgment upon the South for their practice of slavery. Southern preachers responded, calling for a new covenant between God and the South, in which Christians' rights and liberties, and the liberty to secede from the nation, would be their motto, their covenant, their now cause. And in the midst of this, they would always be looking to God. What was God providentially doing? How was God leading in this great war? Generals were glorified, described as heroes and war saints. Stonewall Jackson, Robert E. Lee, Ulysses S. Grant, William Sherman, all hailed as heroes, and the language of saints also, oftentimes being used to describe them and their successes. Lincoln himself was seen often as a messianic figure in which God was using him in such a unique and specific way. Lincoln writes, "The will of God prevails. In great contests, each party claims to act in accordance to the will of God. Both may be, and one must be wrong. God cannot be for and against the same thing at the same time. In the present civil war, it is quite possible that God's purpose is something different from the purpose of either party. And yet the human instrumentalities, working just as they do, are of the best adaptation to effect this purpose. I am almost ready to say this is probably true, that God wills this contest, and wills that it shall not end yet. By his mere great power on the minds of the now contestants, he could have either saved or destroyed the Union without a human contest. If the contest began, and having begun, he could have the final victory to either side in any day if the contest proceeds." Harry Stout comments, "Here we see the first premonition of a sense of destiny that would lift Lincoln above the ranks of partisanship of virtually everyone else and allow him to glimpse a divine purpose to the war that transcended section and ultimately helped him escape the rhetoric or the rhetorical cage of the Jeremiad. This provided Lincoln a Christ-like compassion for his foes and would render him a Christ-like Messiah for the reconstituted American nation." No question, Lincoln weighed this very heavily, what was going on and what was God doing, and arguing very much that God would accomplish his purposes. And it's fascinating to see, if you look just not just from Lincoln, but you look at the major institutions that were producing leaders both in the North and the South. And it's very fascinating to see this kind of, at least from my modern perspective, and looking particularly at modern warfare and how leaders are raised within military ranks. You look today at our generals in the Army and others, it's very clear these guys are career military men and women, many of them trained at military academies like West Point and others and rising through the ranks. It's fascinating to see in the context of the Civil War that a lot of the officers being raised through the ranks, they didn't have long military backgrounds and histories. Many of them, it was primarily that they were well-educated, upper-class, intellectuals that joined in, particularly on the Union side, and then were advanced quickly through the ranks all the way through. Many of them professors at colleges and universities, high-ranking officials politically, not career military guys. Now, again, there were some. You got Grant, you got Lee, and others who were absolutely West Point trained, many years in the military, having served together the Northern and Southern troops, many of the officers having served together in the Mexican-American War and other places, having those careers, but others, not so much. And it's fascinating to see that as graduating classes were coming out of different colleges, there was this religious rhetoric as well as knowing that many of these students that were leaving would be serving in the military, officers and others as well. Horace Bushnell, at the Yale commencement in 1865, declared, "In these rivers of blood, we now have bathed our institutions. They are henceforth to be hallowed in our sight. Government is now become providential, no more a mere creature of our human will, but a grandly moral affair. We have not fought this dreadful war to a close just to put our government on par with these oppressive dynasties of old Europe. We owe it to them to say that a government which is friendly and free and right, protecting all alike, and doing the most for all is one of God's sacred finalities, which no hand may touch or conspiracy assail without committing the most damning crime, such as can be matched by no possible severities of justice." Again, this sense of God having a sacred purpose, that God's will would be done, and this will would be applied now in the conduct of warfare. Now, it's fascinating to see that warfare itself and providence would be intertwined. I'll give you another example of what we mean by providence and its impact. Even Charles Hodge, professor at Princeton Seminary at the time, was absolutely convinced of God's providence and God's ordination of all things, including the war. Hodge responded to it with a tribute to Abraham Lincoln, published in the Princeton Review of July of 1865, in which Hodge makes a number of scriptural points regarding providence. And again, he dedicated this to Lincoln, this article, in which he describes the existence of an external world. There is a world out there that God has created. Again, he's responding to idealistic philosophies of the time, in which Hodge declares the efficiency of secondary causes, human actions, do cause events in the world, Hodge argued. The actions of proximate causes, ordinary events, sequential events in nature, cause and effect, Hodge affirmed all these things, as he wrote in this article. But then he described, over all and surrounding all is the omnipresent and active divine presence. Hodge stated, God as an infinite and omnipresent spirit is not a mere spectator of the world, looking as a machinist upon the machine which he constructed, nor is he the only efficient cause so that all effects are to be referred to his agency, so that the laws of nature are only the uniform methods of this operation, but he is everywhere present, upholding all things by the word of his power, and controlling and guiding and directing the action of second causes, so that all events occur according to the counsel of his will. Hodge declaring, yeah, God uses all these secondary causes. What's happening here is secondary, but God is the omnipresent spirit, upholding all things by the word of his power, is operating through these secondary causes. Hodge is unable to avoid, I would argue also, the spirit and optimism of the North as well. This was for him now an epochal change that God would bring, which he would providentially end slavery in America. This was the expectation of Hodge. Hodge argued that the South was, quote, a system so fraught with evil as to provoke divine displeasure, and the result would be the universal overthrow of slavery within the limits of the United States. This would be one of the most momentous events in the history of the world, wrote Hodge, and that it was the design of God to bring about this event, he did not doubt. Christians had the responsibility to accept the inevitable difficulties and sufferings consequent of such an abrupt change, since they resulted from the design of God in these events. In other words, for Hodge, he absolutely believed God was going to end slavery. God, under his providence, would end slavery. And again, dedicating this to Lincoln, it's very clear that he was encouraging Lincoln as a secondary cause to the end of what God was accomplishing, at least as Hodge thought of it. Now, I don't want to overstate things too much because there were some who did not believe in this providence at all. General Edward Porter Alexander, chief of the Southern Artillery, who campaigned under Stonewall Jackson from 1862 to 1863, had great doubts about religion and about even Jackson's own commitment and faith. Alexander complained about certain Southern generals believing in this mysterious providence. He writes, "There was this mysterious providence always hovering over the field and ready to interfere on one side or the other, and that prayers and piety might win its favor from one day to the next. It was a weakness," Alexander declared, "to imagine that victory could ever come, and in even the slightest degree, from anything except our own exertions." He was convinced these generals, religious guys who believe in providence, thinking God is going to intervene at some point and we need to pray for that, he said, "No way. Victory will be by our own exertions." He criticized Jackson, who I mentioned was a Presbyterian elder and a very religious man. He describes, quote, "I think that one defect in General Jackson's character was his religious beliefs. He believed with absolute faith in a personal God, watching over all human events with a jealous eye to his own glory, ready to reward those people who made it their chief care and to punish those who forgot about it. And he specifically believed that a particular day had been set aside every week for the praise of this God, and that a personal account was strictly kept with every man as to how he kept this day." Of course, as a good Southern old school Presbyterian elder, Jackson was a strict Sabbatarian and being criticized here by Alexander for his religious practice. "It's customary to say that Providence did not intend that we should win," Alexander writes, "but Providence didn't care a row of pins about it. If it did, it was a very unintelligent Providence not to bring the business to a close, that close it wanted, in less than 4 years of most terrible and bloody warfare." Now, let me end today with this point. I mentioned all this about Providence. Remember the early quote I started out with. What would motivate someone to legitimize such horrible atrocities in war, killing to the extent that this one general would describe Cold Harbor, that battle, as a murder, which is killing each other? What would justify this? On one hand, Providence, if you believe this is God's purpose and cause. On the second hand, if you believed so much in your cause that you believed that God was bringing judgment on your enemies. Harry Stout notes a fascinating turn that happens in military history in the Civil War. As I mentioned before, Cold Harbor and the wars and battles of the Civil War, and even in Europe at that time, was this very civil, gentlemanly way of conducting warfare. You line up, you shoot each other. You march forward, you shoot each other. No one's hiding, and they even had codes of conduct, right? Don't shoot the generals, don't shoot the officers, because an army without an officer is havoc, and we can't have that. We can't have that kind of anarchy on the battlefield. Note, a major turn happens when General Sherman marches southward, cuts through the South. What does he do? Total war, exactly. All of a sudden now, it's not just lining up on the battlefield. He goes and starts burning towns, starts killing civilians. The rhetoric from the North is, "We are now God's instruments of judgment." And it changed the nature of warfare at that time when you move from this gentlemanly battle on the battlefield to Sherman now devastating the South by cutting through in total warfare, burning, killing, pillaging in the South. And of course, for Southerners, that left a very, very heavy impression upon the Southern mindset of the North as a result of that. But justified, in part at least, when you listen to the rhetoric and the writings, that they were the instrument of God now, that God was laying judgment upon the South. And I would argue that language, some secular historians, they skip over it very lightly. They say, it's just the rhetoric of the day. No, I'm convinced it's not just the rhetoric. but it was the commitment too, religious commitment, to believe that God was doing something and that God was doing something through you. That even Charles Hodge writes to clarify secondary causes and God as the primary cause who brings all things to completion. Yeah. Fascinating to me to see how religion is intertwined in a part of this context of the Civil War as well. We'll go ahead and stop here and I'll come back next week and look a little bit more at this.